Welcome to Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and I'm here on the fourth Monday of each month to bring you an hour devoted to our culture of music. On this show, I'm very pleased to bring you a special interview with English queer rocker Tom Robinson. But I open the show with a very obscure song by a lesbian artist, also from England. Her name is Polly Perkins, and she started out in the early 60s with a handful of Pop 45s. And the best one, in my opinion, was from 1964, a cover version of the Marlene Dietrich song, Falling in Love Again. By the late 70s, she was known more for her jazzy songs, like one called I'm a Super Dyke, and an album called Liberated Lady. By 1979, she was the most openly lesbian entertainer in England up to that time, and was popular on the pub circuit. But she didn't fare very well at the rally in Hyde Park following the Gay Pride March. She sang her Super Dyke song dressed in spangly hot pants, and as some of the gay politicos there thought this was pandering to male fantasies, they dragged her off the stage. This was the highly charged gay liberation front climate of the times. And in it, Tom Robinson gave one of my favorite of his recorded concerts, later released on an album called Cabaret 79. But before we get to the Tom Robinson interview, I want to digress just a little. Okay, how many of you knew that there was a secret gay language in England in the 50s and 60s? Raise your hands. Not too many. It was a slang language called Polari, spelled P-O-L-A-R-I. In those days, gay men used it as a form of protection and secrecy. Outsiders would not be able to tell what you were talking about, and it also had a humorous and campy element. It was derived from a variety of sources, such as Italian words, rhyming slang, and backslang, which was saying a word as if it were spelled backwards. Theater people and also gay men in the Merchant Marines also contributed various words. There were probably about 500 Polari terms, and they included words for types of people, occupations, body parts, clothing, and sexual acts, and they were ideal for gossip. I've got a couple of examples to introduce you to Polari. In the late 60s, there was a very popular radio comedy show on the BBC with characters named Julian and Sandy. They used a lot of Polari words, and most of their sketches had the word bona in the title. Bona meant nice. It seemed in each sketch they had a different occupation. In this one, from 1965, they were interior decorators.
We called the firm Hay Bones and Boner Gardens.
We did. Lovely. We soon had our first tickle. It was only a semi in Hendon, but it was a start.
Yeah. Good morning.
Morning. We're Hay Bones and Boner Gardens.
Come in before the neighbours see you. Now, this is my living room.
Oh, nasty! Never mind, Jewel. You can express yourselves on his drapes.
Yes.
Go on.
Oh, we've got some boner curtain material.
He has. Really, babe. Show him your swatch. Go on, get it out. Your
swatch. Oh, yes.
Go
yes,
on, get
swatch.
It out. Be bold.
Have a vada at this.
Have a vada. Swatch. Yes.
Here you've got your velvets.
Velvet.
Oh, it comes lovely in the plum.
Comes lovely in the plum.
Or the tangerine.
Comes lovely in the tangerine.
Mm.
Or the navy. Comes lovely in the navy. Doesn't it?
Yes. But for me, it's all down to black leather.
Black leather curtains?
Very kinky.
Yeah.
But here, perhaps, is a better example of Polari in the form of a song by English drag performer Lee Sutton, from a 1971 album by her called Drag for Camp Followers. The song is called Bona Eek, which means, as you'll find out, nice face. After her song, she gives a translation, but I'll warn you that she wasn't on the up and up with it, as a couple of the harmless translations she gives are not at all what the naughty meanings convey. But the audience went right along.
We're going to do a little number now. This may be a bit of a mystery to some of you because it is written in a foreign language. But in the second half, we do explain it, what it's all about. We do our best. Bo freak, Bonerick. My heart starts a racket every time I see your packet, Bonerick. Your popularity almost makes me spring a leak. I grant your every wish, I'd even grease my dish, but I love your explanation time. Bonerick, nice fat, wait for me. You've got the campiest little Bonerick. You've got a nice face for a woman, even though you are a fella. And when you look at me, it leaves me weak. Bonerick. My heart starts a racket every time I see your packet. I get so excited when I look at your wages. Bonerick. Your popularity almost makes me spring a leak. Whenever you speak your mind, I almost lose control of myself. I grant your every wish, I'd even grease my dish, I'd even cook for you. But I love your
again, that was Lee Sutton, who always was billed as Lee Sutton, a near miss. Polari fell out of use for two main reasons. I've already told you about the radio series Julian and Sandy had in the late 60s. Well, that series was so popular that the general public learned many of the Polari words, so some of the mystery of the language was erased. Also, in 1967, homosexuality was decriminalized in England, so there was less need for a secret language. And the gay rights politics of the 70s and 80s considered it passé. But there is one interesting modern example, in musical form, by another singer from England, Morrissey. He was lead singer of the Smiths and is well known in his own right, but always was very ambiguous sexually. He's recorded some very gay songs, but would never comment about his own orientation. In 1990, he surprisingly titled his new album, Bona Drag, which starts out with his song called Piccadilly Polari. Watch out for the line, So bona avada, O you, your lovely eek and your lovely Rhea, which means, so nice to see you with your lovely face and hair. Here's a little of Piccadilly Polari by Morrissey.
Polari was just silly slang between me
Morrissey with Piccadilly Pilari from his 1990 album, Bona Drag. Now onto the main focus of this show. Tom Robinson has long been a musical hero of mine, dating back to his 1978 anthem, Glad to be Gay, and many wonderful songs and albums since. He was one of my dream interviews, and that came true in June when he hosted the Out Music Awards in New York City. I was able to arrange some time with him and captured about 70 minutes of wonderful and thoughtful answers to questions about his music and his struggles with being gay and then bisexual. Naturally, I cannot fit 70 minutes of talk into this hour show, but for those of you who want to hear the complete interview, I've uploaded it to my website for this month, where you also find lots of photos of Tom. On to the interview. How would you describe your career to someone who has never heard of you?
I'd have to say that my career as a queer musician really started with a suicide attempt, where in my early teens I fell in love with somebody, as you do in your early teens. It was somebody of the same sex, and at that time, if you were queer, you went to prison in the UK for 4 years. It was an imprisonable offence. So that meant that there was not role model one for a gay teenager any place in England or Britain. And I would rather have died than admit to anybody else I was in love with this other boy at school, and that was the option I chose. I took an overdose of pills and had a nervous breakdown as a result. And it was really, although I recovered from that and was saved by a very great teacher and healer called George Lywood, it wasn't until my early 20s when David Bowie turned up and sang You're Not Alone, and suddenly, you know, on the Bush Telegraph, you knew what that meant. Oh, you pretty things, John, I'm only dancing. You heard songs suddenly, for the first time, instead of being almost about your life, reflecting an emotional experience that you felt except all the pronouns were wrong, suddenly it was actually about your life. And I resolved to myself that if ever in the future I had an opportunity to do that for somebody else and pass it on so that the idea could spread, then I would do my damnedest to do it. David Bowie had an incalculable effect on my life, because for the first time at school or among young people, you could be queer and you could be one of the good guys. Up until that point in Britain, that had never, ever happened. That meant that when I first got into a band, even though it wasn't my band, I did my best to do my bit. And on the side from the band's main music career, I started appearing at gay benefits, writing queer songs, and turning up for Gay Liberation Front dues, and eventually appearing at Pride. And in Pride 76, I got up and wrote a song called Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay, specifically for that occasion. And when I quit that first band that I was in, Cafe Society, I was able to form a band of my own and do whatever the hell I liked. And I'd just seen the Sex Pistols performing, and it was clear that you could do whatever you liked and get away with it for the first time, and that confronting the audience was not necessarily going to be a problem. So I thought I'd try out Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay in pubs and clubs and scummy dives and places around London where we were playing. And bizarrely, instead of throwing bottles at the stage, people went, yeah, that's all right. And it was a great lesson, really, that people will treat you, if you're honest and straight with them, so to speak, they will often respect you for that more than they will if you're trying to conceal yourself.
Can you tell us a little more about the writing of that song?
The reason I came to write Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay was because there were little yellow badges that said Glad to Be Gay on them that were in wide circulation in the London gay scene around 1975-76. They were particularly popular among the Campaign for Homosexual Equality supporters, those CHE. CHE ran an assimilationist campaign where it was kind of gradual change through due political process and not rocking the boat too much. And it meant that at those discos that they ran, people would be wearing their Glad to Be Gay badges, and then they'd come out into the street and take them off again, put them in their pockets. And at the same time, police brutality toward gay people had been upped in the long hot summer of 1976, and the police began raiding gay pubs And people were taking it too. I mean, there wasn't any kind of Stonewall reaction against that. And so I was infuriated by the fact that on the one hand, the organizations that should be campaigning for that were running little low-key discos in town where you could wear a Glad to be Gay badge, and then you'd come out, hide the badge, and not do anything about what was going on the streets to your brothers and sisters further down the road. So Glad to be Gay was a bitterly ironic attack on the complacency of the gay community at the time, rather than a proclamation that one was glad to be gay.
The British police are the best in the world. I don't believe one of these stories I've heard about them raiding our pubs for no reason at all. Lining the customers up by the wall, picking out people, knocking them down, resisting arrest as they're kicked on the ground, searching their houses, calling them queer. I don't believe that sort of thing happens here. Sing if you're glad to be gay.
What were the influences on the Tom Robinson Band?
When I left my first band, Cafe Society, and wanted to form something that really reflected my own concerns about the political situation in the country, and indeed about the musical concerns of punk rock, which were basic and a lot more tough than Cafe Society had been, I wanted it to be real, heartfelt, and sort of heart on the sleeve, really. I mean, as you found it. I was profoundly influenced by the Kinks because I'd been signed to the Kinks label, and Ray Davies had signed Cafe Society and produced its first album. So there was always a strand of music hall running through the Tom Robinson Band, which sat ill at ease, perhaps, with the more rock and roll direction that the band took with the acquisition of the other members and the general musical direction that we took alongside the Clash, Sex Pistols, Jam, Stranglers, Elvis Costello, Ian Dury, the other kind of artists who were emerging at that time. I always felt that the music had to come first, though, because nobody gives a toss what your political opinions are or what your sexual politics are if your music's rubbish. You have to get the music right first. Nobody would ever have asked me any questions about Glad to be Gay at all, let alone sign me to a record deal, if the band hadn't delivered musically and on the basis of entertainment when people paid their money to go into a pub and see us play, if we hadn't done a great show and left people with songs that they sang when they came out of the door, then my political opinions or whatever other work we did would have been irrelevant.
I've got an article from a 1978 Advocate that talks about your first hit, 2468 Motorway, and has you describing the inspiration for the 2468 part.
I have certain strengths as a songwriter, I guess, that have come to the fore in the course of 30 years, and some areas that aren't great strengths, and I've never had huge strengths as an innovator. I'm good at putting ideas together and articulating them, and pulling together strands and making things work. But in all honesty, I'm not the most musically original or even lyrically original writer of my experience, and I've tended to borrow from sources and put things together in a way that somebody hasn't bothered to put them together before that seems to work. And with 2468 Motorway, the hook came straight off the gay and lesbian marches that I'd been on as an activist during the early 70s, where people were chanting 2468, gay is twice as good as straight, 3579, lesbians are mighty fine. So when I was trying to put together a chorus for that song, I just thought, well, I happen to know it firsthand that large numbers of people can chant that and enjoy it, and that it works with a kind of stomping beat. So I freely acknowledge that's where the chorus for that song came from.
coming up with the morning light.
In the late 80s, you faced a backlash when the British media had a field day over your living with a woman. Can you talk about that?
Having enjoyed a period of notoriety as an out gay pop singer in the 70s, shock horror, he sleeps with men, I then bizarrely had a further brush with the tabloids where shock horror, man sleeps with woman. And 2 years after I'd openly talked in the Pink Paper and Capital Gay about the fact that I was, to my surprise, found myself living with a woman. Suddenly, one of the tabloid papers got hold of it and thought, oh, what a great story. It was some years since my last hit record in the UK, and I had really no idea that anyone gave a toss about what my, you know, what I would be doing at all. So it was a complete shock when somebody from the Sunday People called up my manager and said, can we do an interview with Tom about his sex life? You know, and she said, you know, sod off. So they came round to my house and battered on the door and shouted through the letterbox, can we do an interview with you about your sex life? And I said, no. And then they waited outside the house till my partner came home from work on her motorbike, and they snapped a picture of her and said, can we interview you about your sex life? And she said, no. And so they then tracked down my father on holiday in France and said, can we interview you about your son's sex life? And he said, sod off. And I thought that was the end of it. But then that Sunday I was in the newsagents and I saw a copy of the Sunday People, and it said on the front, inside, exclusive interview with Tom Robinson. And it really went against the grain, but I had to buy a copy. So I got it home and opened it up, and then the centre page in colour, there was a double page spread which had the headline, Britain's number one gay in love with girl biker, My Passion for Blonde by Rocker Robinson. It was all made up. It was just creepy, just really, really creepy. A friend says he's so happy now he's not gay anymore. And, you know, how dare they? How dare they presume to know how my relationship worked or what went on behind our closed doors? For the record, I've never claimed to be anything other than gay. And it's only with reluctance that I came to, about 10 years later, to say, oh, sod it. You know, if living with a woman makes me bisexual, okay, I'm bisexual. If that makes it easier for you to understand how I fancy men happen to be living with the person I want to spend the rest of my life with, who happens to be female, then, okay, I'm bisexual, I'm proud. And I started going to bisexual pride events and said, look, you know, I'm not the only one this has happened to. And why the hell not? And I had a kind of homecoming with the bisexual community around the late 90s, around 97 or so, where for the first time in 10 years, Pride in the UK invited me to appear again at Pride, but it wasn't Pride main stage, it was the Pride bisexual tent. And I just walked out onto the stage with a guitar in my hand, and people shouted, hey Tom, where have you been? I said, making babies, and they all cheered. And it was like, great, because I was at a queer event with people with whom I could say, yeah, I've been making babies, and they went, yeah, so have we. It's cool. And it was like a second coming out all over again, to be welcomed back into the arms of the queer community, fully validated. And so I've been appearing at Pride events and events like Out Music and Glamour and things with a new kind of assurance that I'm not a freak, that I'm not an oddity or somebody or a traitor or something, that this is just human experience, that sexuality is a wide and many splendid thing that deviates from the heterosexual norm in all kinds of ways. And I just happen to be experiencing one of them.
It sounds like you're not entirely comfortable with the label bisexual.
I was quite reluctant in the first instance to come to use the word bisexual with regard to myself, because I didn't feel any different inside from the way I had always felt. I always found men attractive. I still find men attractive. I figure, you know, out of every 200 men that pass on the street, I'm going to go, you know, 100 of those are nice-looking guys. Now, with every 200 women that pass on the street, maybe one is going to turn my head. It's hard to find a way to put this into words. I've had sexual relations with many, many men, in common with most gay men of my generation. You know, the numbers, well, after a while you lose count. And that's just the way it is. It's not a gay thing, it's a male thing. Men are not particular about having to have an emotional rapport. You know, it's not the same as women, particularly heterosexual women, like to actually have some idea of who it is they're having sex with and some kind of relationship with the person, in my experience. I hope I'm not maligning anybody by saying that. But in my experience, heterosexual men would like to be promiscuous, but they aren't able to find enough women to be promiscuous with. A promiscuous heterosexual man will boast that he's had 80 partners in the last 10 years. And you know, they think that's really a big deal. And gay men tend, on the whole, to laugh at that, because it's men seeking men, and suddenly that constraint is removed. And so, of course, we have a great deal more partners. It's to do with being male. It's not to do with being gay, particularly. So the vast majority of my sexual experience has been with other men. I sleep with one woman, and suddenly I'm a bisexual. The difference being that the one woman that I slept with is the one I fell in love with and wanted to spend the rest of my life with.
There have been artists who I won't name who have lost credibility when they, quote, switched. I think your approach kept you your credibility.
Part of the problem that I experienced with people who read about my living with a woman via the straight press was that we had had some disappointments in the past, where people like Lou Reed and David Bowie, who had been iconic for us in our coming out and who had made a huge difference to us in reflecting our experience in their lyrics, publicly and vocally backtracked from their position, disassociated themselves, said, "I'd never really meant that. Oh, it was all just for publicity." They distanced themselves from that earlier experience and made us feel kind of dirty by them disassociating themselves in that way. We didn't feel dirty because we felt proud of ourselves, but they made it seem like they felt we ought to. And that was such a disappointment. I guess then when the guy who had sung Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay appeared via the press to be announcing, you know, that he had turned straight too, then they thought, oh, not another one. As I say, I've never claimed to be straight or to have turned straight or to have stopped being queer in any sense whatsoever. It's merely an expansion, you know. In addition to my repertoire, I had added a further experience. Hey, I mean, all my lesbian friends have been telling me for years and years about how fab women were, you know? And I found out in this particular instance they were dead right.
If you're down in London town and happen to be gay, there's a great information service open every day. They'll tell you who and where and when and how and why and more on 8377324. 8377324.
That was Tom's gay switchboard jingle, recorded in 1978, and that phone number is still good. And this is a good time to invite you to visit my website at www.queermusicheritage.com, where you can view the playlist and see photos of the artists and recordings, and listen to the show anytime. And also, be sure to listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Saturday night from midnight to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's Queer Radio with Attitude.
Yeah, 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 we'll listen to the radio.
Hi, you're listening to Queer Music Heritage with J.D. Doyle and me, Tom Robinson.
What is the first song you think of when I ask, of what song are you the most proud?
My flip answer to the question of which song I'm most proud of is actually Wish I Had a Grey Cortina, because it had a simple message to put over and did it very, very succinctly in very few words and conveyed quite a detailed idea. Wish I had a grey Cortina, whiplash aerial racing trim. Cortina, Rona, no one meaner, wish that I could be like him. It was a piece of pop nonsense which I was able to just kind of put together and throw out, and no other song that I've ever written was quite as succinct as that. But the true answer is War Baby is the song that I'm most proud of. The genesis of War Baby came at a low ebb in my life when I had run out of money and got massively into debt, particularly with the British tax authorities, and I had to flee the country and go and live on a friend's floor in Hamburg. And I really didn't know what was going to happen to me. But I was there, and I started writing some new songs. And he used to roll the most ferocious joints, large conical things that would just sort of remove all semblance of reality. And I used to somehow drive through the streets of Hamburg in my second-hand 20-year-old car, with the steering wheel on the wrong side, and make it to the gay sauna in that state, and kind of salve my soul through experiences there. And one particular evening, I made it back to the flat somehow, particularly stoned, after a particularly kind of harrowing experienced the sauna, and just came back and wrote straight down, "Only the very young and the very beautiful can be so aloof." And the rest of it poured out onto the page, about 8-10 pages of the stuff, just handwritten, stream of consciousness stuff. And it took about a year to get those 10 pages down to something that you could actually sing in 4 minutes. But it came right from a very, very deep place within me. I think it's the most truthful song that I've written, because I didn't think about it at all. The great artist is able to connect with a very deep part of themselves spontaneously, and I think that's the closest I ever came to doing it.
Oh, the very young and the very beautiful can be so aloof, hanging out with the boys, all swaggering boys. I don't even care what other people are there. I just stare and stare and stare. I see a shadow in the swimming pool. I see your face in the shaving mirror. Time and time and time again, I follow your footsteps so quietly up the back stairs. And I hope and I pray you ain't never gonna find me there. Smooth skin and tenderness, long ago in a dark night. Wish I could see you once again to remember that it was true. I wanna be still beside you, quiet and still beside you. Listen to your breathing and feeling your warmth again. Whoa.
Please tell me about the song More Lives Than One.
More Lives Than One was kind of prophetic in a sort of way, because I was asked to write some music for a BBC play for Today in the early 80s while I was in the middle of a passionate love affair with the big gay love of my life, to whom I dedicated the whole Still Loving You album. And we wrote the music together for this particular play on the TV. And it needed a theme song to run through the credits. So I put together More Lives Than One, because it was about a closeted bisexual man who was having sex on the side, unbeknown to his wife. And so the lines, you know, I'm sitting in the middle and it's hitting more lives than one, was about that. And then I resurrected it as a live performing piece in the early 90s because it just seemed a kind of ironic reflection on my own situation, except, of course, that the woman that I lived with and eventually married knew me as a gay man in the first place, liked me as a gay man in the first place, and found my gayness a huge part of the attraction and turn-on, which first threw us together. So there wasn't the element of hypocrisy that there was for the guy in the song.
After day I've been living in dread, cheating at work, lying in bed. No hard feelings, just a bit of regret. I could have been lying in your arms instead. I'm glad that I married and I love my kids. I wish I'd never met you, but I'm glad that I did. Now I'm sitting in the middle, trying to fit in more lives than one. Day after day, I've been slipping away, playing the game that I don't wanna play. Sooner or later, there's a reckoning day. I'm so, so sorry, but what can I say? I feel like a heel, but I can't decide between the life I always wanted and the loving that I like. It's a bitter situation, overtaking more lives than one.
Tell me about the song Blood Brother.
When you write songs, most writers I know have a little black notebook. It could be any colour, that they put fragments of ideas in as they occur to them. The fragment that started Blood Brother was walking with your brother, your sister, your mother, so well behaved, which just didn't sound like anything. But it was a vision of a teenage boy who's just got, like, a bit too old to be dragged around by his mother on a shopping expedition, and kind of imprisoned by being told by his mother he's got to go down into town on a shopping expedition. And that was all contained in this idea of being, you know, so well behaved, the inner life at total odds with the outer life, and this kind of outwardly conformist idea for this teenage kid. So I started trying to work out what this was, how this could be a song, what was this about. It didn't sound like a line from a song. As I started writing, this whole story poured out, again, just in prose, over 10 pages or something, about this boy. I just wrote down everything I could think of about him, that he was red-haired, that he freckled, lived on a farm with his family, he was the youngest kid. And again, it didn't sound like much like a song, but I ended up with a whole story. And then I managed to condense that down into something that I could sing. But there was much more detail in the original story than made it to the final song. But there are resonances of all the original story in the song.
The song's an award winner.
The song eventually won an award because at the end of the first draft, it came to the line, "Open your eyes, here I am, I'm your blood brother." And suddenly I realized that isn't the end of the song, that's the actual hook of the song. And it gradually emerged that this was not a song about teenagers growing up. This was a song about bisexuality, and a song more specifically about the spectre of AIDS. And it's all very understated, although much clearer in the original story. And I think the resonances make it work. And again, it's a song that means a lot to me personally.
Born in Lincoln County, and he grew up in the Fens. Teased and bullied by his brothers,
in a family of ten. So she'll pull a musico in, helping out around the home. While it's in a life ticked on like an unexploded bomb, just waiting for its moment. Shopping with his mother like a whippet on the leaf, always straining at the traces, out of sight and out of reach. And any time the house was empty, he would work out on his own, disappearing on his bike in the middle of the night, stealing from the kitchen. Open your eyes, open your eyes, open your eyes. Here I am, I'm your blood brother.
From the album Cabaret 79, tell me about Glad to Be Gay.
Glad to Be Gay had a precedent that while I was working in Cafe Society and keeping my gay activism compartmentalized as a little side activity in a way that eventually proved untenable, my first side project was writing a little sing-along morale booster for the troops for an earlier gay conference called Good to Be Gay, and the CHE organization, Campaign for Homosexual Equality, paid to press up, I think, 500 copies of it on vinyl and then sell it at the conference as a fundraiser. So it's the same old story all over the world. When a boy meets a boy, and then the lesbians come in, and a girl meets a girl, we all live. We all sing, is it we all sing together? Because we're happy to say it's a natural fact that it's good to be gay. So that song was actually called Glad to Be Gay. And initially when I got up and sang the song we now know as Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay at the Pride event, it was Glad to Be Gay Part 2. So having started out with naive optimism, it was then the bitter, the savage disappointment of the second song that took over.
Good to Be Gay was more optimistic.
It was Pollyanna. Good to Be Gay was just kind of Pollyanna. I was still learning my chops as a songwriter, and it, you know, didn't have any kind of depth or anything to it, but I was just trying to write something that people would sing along with. And at that time, we didn't have any kind of gay music that was written specifically for our community, so, you know, anything was better than nothing. I'm not particularly proud of it as a piece of writing in the long run, except that it enabled me to learn how to write songs and gradually get better.
I also loved your version of Mad About the Boy from that album.
Yeah, I love Mad About the Boy. It is a marvelous song. What's poignant about Mad About the Boy was that apart from Matalow, where he came very close to revealing his true self, Coward had to sublimate his gay sexuality in terms of public expression, because simply it was an imprisonable offence at the time in the UK. You couldn't declare your homosexuality in the way that we can now. I mean, these are different times in the UK. So one senses, rightly or wrongly, in Mad About the Boy, a sublimated yearning, and that Coward himself had felt very much like that. And so in performing it, I've tried to kind of put myself in his shoes.
I met him at a party just a couple of years ago. He was rather over-hearty and ridiculous. But as I'd seen him on the screen, he cast a certain spell. I basked in his attraction for a couple of hours or so. His manners were a fraction too meticulous. If he was real or not, I couldn't tell. But like a silly fool, I fell mad about the boy. I know it's stupid, but I'm mad about the boy. I'm so ashamed of it, but must admit the sleepless nights I've had about the boy. On the silver screen, he haunts my foolish heart in every single scene. Although I'm quite aware that here and there are traces of the cad about the boy. Lord knows I'm not a fool girl. I really shouldn't care. Lord knows I'm not a schoolgirl in the flurry of a first affair. Will it ever cloy, this odd diversity of misery and joy? I'm feeling quite insane and young again, and all because I'm mad about the boy.
One of my favorites of your songs is Never Gonna Fall in Love Again. Can you talk a little about it?
In many ways, one of my favorite gay songs of all the ones that I wrote that had a specifically openly amorous gay theme. I like Never Gonna Fall in Love Again because I sent the lyric to Elton John and he came back with the music for it. And so it was a collaboration between two gay artists. And he is a great songwriter, there's no question. So it's got good changes and a decent melody. And his version, of course, was a slow ballad and a bit drippy, to be honest. And although he sent me back a demo which had all the pronouns as I'd written them, when he recorded himself, he kind of slurred them a bit. So where it's, I wish he didn't make me rabid, it was, I wish he didn't make, you know, it was just a little bit on the ambiguous side. But that's all right. You know, that was where he was at the time, and what Elton has done, A, for the gay movement, and B, in the fight against AIDS with the Elton John AIDS Foundation, you know, is fantastic, and we owe a huge debt to the man. So I think he's allowed to slur a few of his pronouns here and there.
Time this week, just about to fall again.
I've got one more question to ask Tom, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and to especially thank Tom Robinson for the very special interview. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write to me at qmheritage@aol.com, and I wish you would. My website, logically enough, is at www.queermusicheritage.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston, and I'll be back on the fourth Monday of next month with the next installment of Queer Music Heritage. In recent years, in addition to his music, Tom has been taking on an additional role, as he's been hosting his own radio show on the BBC, and he tells me he's thoroughly enjoying learning about and sharing the music of many of today's artists. I want to highly recommend Tom's own website, www.tomrobinson.com. I think it is about the perfect example of what an artist's site should be. It's packed full of information about his music and career and his bisexual activism. It's very organized and graphically excellent. A wonderful site. Last question. Tom, how do you think the song Glad to Be Gay has fared over the years?
I asked a gay activist in London, Eric Preslin, to help me with the updating the lyrics once. I have periodically updated them from year to year. And he wrote back, repeating an old joke where a businessman drives through the country and pulls up beside a farm labourer who's leaning on a gate and says, how do I get to Liverpool from here? And the labourer says, if I were going to Liverpool, I wouldn't start from here. And in a way, that's right. I mean, Glad to Be Gay is a period piece. It is of its time, and updating it, you know, isn't going to make it a modern song. I don't know. There's something probably to be said for singing it again with its original lyrics and its original context and just leaving it at that rather than trying to bring it up to date. And yet, you know, you can't help putting Matthew Shepard in it or putting AIDS in it or George Michael in it. You know, when these events happen, it seems daft not to go on a stage and actually drag them in.
Has the version with the Matthew Shepard verse been recorded?
There's no recording of the Matthew Shepard version, though. That's only been added in the last 12 months.
Well, at the end of our interview, he graced me with singing a little bit of Glad to Be Gay, with the new verses, done very acoustic, just with his guitar and an audience of one. What a treat that was. How often does one of your musical icons sing a major gay anthem just for you? Well, I'm pleased to share it. Tom Robinson's Glad to Be Gay.
In the world, I don't believe one of these stories I've heard about pretty policemen in leather and jeans showing their leg through a split in the seams, seeking out superstars, leading them on, then running them in when they start to respond. But back home in Britain, we're equal and free, except when the case is a Labour MP. Sing if you're glad to be gay, sing if you're happy that way. Sing if you're glad to be gay, sing if you're happy that way. Now young Matthew Shepard was killed in the States, left alone dying and tied to a gate. For being a pretty and gay 21, he was tortured by kids who thought killing was fun. At his funeral, Christian love showed its face as the bigots all picketed, twisted with hate. But God doesn't hate fags, you sickos, it's true. He even loves people as evil as you.
A Queer Music Heritage exclusive.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Just sing if you're happy that way. For 29 years now I've fought for the right for people to love just whoever they like. Today as we laugh as we march in the park,
And clause 28's just a climb to the past. The Admiral Duncan, the victims of hate. Let's remember the friends we've all lost on the way. Bisexual, lesbian, glad to be gay. We're here and we're queer and we won't go away. Cause we sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy this way.